You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. My name is Beth Ferris. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings and co-director of the Brookings LSE Project on Internal Displacement. There's been a lot of news about Syria these past couple of weeks. We've heard about chemical weapons and possibilities of U.S. intervention and deals being struck with Russia and perhaps members of the Security Council even as we speak. But absent from many of those discussions has been the situation of people, ordinary Syrians, civilians, displaced refugees on the ground. This is the greatest humanitarian crisis facing the world today, and we hope in today's program to talk about the humanitarian reality, but also about some of the political implications of this. We've just launched our report earlier this morning, which is called Syria's Crisis, Massive Displacement, Dire Needs and a Shortage of Solutions. That was co-authored by myself, Salman Sheikh, and Kamal Qureshi, who particularly spoke about Turkey. And as we'll be doing more on Turkey later this year, we thought we'd focus today more on the actual humanitarian situation. In terms of today's program, I'm going to give a brief overview of our report and the kind of the current status of humanitarian reality in Syria. We'll then turn to two of our colleagues, begin with Francois Stamm, who's head of the regional delegation for the International Committee of the Red Cross here in Washington. Their bios are in the packets you picked up, so I won't repeat that, but has many years of humanitarian experience in very different situations. And so we look forward to hearing his observations, particularly how is Syria different from the many other tragedies that the world has experienced. We'll then turn to my colleague, Salman Sheikh, who's the director of our program in Doha in Qatar, who's been working particularly on issues of transitions in the Middle East, following political developments, looking also at the role of the Gulf states and Gulf actors, and we look forward to hearing his comments on the political implications. I note that we, in a social media world, we have a hashtag for this event. If any of you are tweeting and would like to refer to that, that would be great. And I also will tell you that on Monday there will be another program on humanitarian assistance to Syria, particularly focusing on the role of Islamic organizations and the unique role that they play. Let me begin with just a very short overview about what we know about the humanitarian situation in Syria. We know, or it's been widely reported, that 100,000 people have died in the last 18 months. That's a comparable figure to the number of deaths over 10 years in the Iraq War. We receive very little news about the number who have been wounded, but a conservative estimate would be 300,000, a 3-to-1 ratio. In some conflicts now, that's 10-to-1. But 300,000 wounded, particularly in a country where the health care system has collapsed, brings a particular hardship. 2 million refugees in neighboring countries, that figure was reached last week. Projections are that it will go up to 3.5 million by the end of the year. I draw your attention to the fact it's only September. It's not that long until the end of the year. Over 4 million people displaced within the country, and statistics on internal displacement are much softer than those for refugees. You know, when a refugee crosses a border, he or she can be counted inadequately because there are always some people who aren't in part of the official registration process. But for those who are displaced within the country, it's very difficult to have anybody keeping tabs on who is displaced, or even what displacement is. Colleagues working in the humanitarian world in Syria say that most Syrians are not sleeping in their homes. But say you go to visit an aunt in the countryside because things are getting too hot in your city, and you come back and then you move on and on. How do you count the number of people displaced? It's really quite a difficult issue. We're going to be focusing on displacement, both internal displacement and refugees. But I want to point out that these may not be the most vulnerable groups in the country. Those who are unable to leave their homes, those who are trapped, if you will, largely inaccessible and largely invisible to the internationals and sometimes to the local groups, may be far more vulnerable. I worry, for example, about the fact that before this crisis, 6.5% of Syria's population was over the age of 65. Less than 2% of the refugees are in that age category. Does that mean that older people are less likely to move? Maybe physical ailments. Maybe it's more difficult for grandmothers to pack up their belongings and take off than for their kids. Well, what does that mean for the humanitarian reality inside Syria? You know, displacement in Syria has been rapid. A year ago, there were 200,000 refugees. Today, over 2 million. You know, that's a very fast pace. It's been large scale, the largest movement of people in the Middle East since the Palestinians, followed by the Iraqis, presenting a tremendous pressure on host governments, which have found hundreds of thousands of refugees on their doorstep. An average of about 5,000 Syrians a day are leaving their country. It's also dynamic. People move multiple times. When I was in Jordan not too long ago, a representative of the Jordanian Foreign Ministry said, "We're stop number 4. Most of the refugees have been displaced 3 or more times inside Syria before making it to a border." And there are uneven patterns of displacement. As you might imagine, people living closer to border areas are more likely to make it across the border and to become a refugee. And it's hard for many people to think that refugees are the lucky ones. But indeed, in comparison with those who are internally displaced or those unable to move, they may, in fact, be the lucky ones. People leaving, of course, because of the war, the threats, the bombing, the intimidation, the widespread fear, the uncertainty, but also because conditions inside Syria are rapidly becoming unbearable. Just a few quick statistics, all from UN sources. GDP's decreased by 50% to 60%, unemployment over 50%, healthcare system has collapsed. Aleppo, the number of doctors has fallen from an estimated 2,000 to 35 to 100. Many medical procedures being carried out in basements and spare rooms, nursing students being called in to perform complex operations. In June of this year, according to the government, 57% of the hospitals were functioning. Most ambulances out of commission, blood reserves seriously compromised, local production of medicines fallen by 90%. Water availability decreased by a third. It's hard to get chemicals for water purification. More food insecurity. Every step of the agricultural production cycle has been affected. Education has been dramatically affected. As of this summer, 20% of schools were reported as not functioning, but I suspect the actual numbers are higher. And certainly lots of reports of Syrians keeping their kids out of schools because they're afraid or the uncertainty of the situation. The long-term impact of the educational disparities inside Syria and indeed in the refugee situation is a very troubling issue when you think about Syria's long-term future. Solomon will talk more about the regional dimension, but for each of the 5 main hosting countries, you know, the arrival of large numbers of refugees not only causes immediate financial and economic costs. I mean, even in countries where Syrian refugee kids are allowed to go to school, I mean, what does it mean for an education ministry in terms of numbers of teachers and classrooms and double shifting and finding the money? And these are complex operational issues. They also raise in all of the countries security concerns. Solomon can talk further about this, but I think it's fair to say that all countries in the region are fearful of a spillover of the conflict or of the relationship between the arrival of large numbers of mostly 90%+ Sunni refugees on their borders, you know, the impact on sometimes tense and complex sectarian ethnic relationships within their countries is a concern. For example, many Sunni refugees arriving in Lebanon are being settled or taking up settlement in the Bekaa Valley, which is Hezbollah-controlled, you know, creating the possibility and the actuality for day-to-day skirmishes and conflict and tensions and perhaps a destabilization of neighboring countries. So the political consequences, as well as the security and the basic humanitarian imperative to care for those and protect those who've been forced to flee for no word of their own. The governments have all implemented some kind of restrictions on entry, But by and large, the hospitality of governments in the region is something to admire and appreciate and uphold. You know, stories of Jordanian border guards cradling Syrian children who make it across the border and saying, "You're safe now. You're safe now." I mean, there's something very special about what's happening in the Middle East that we need to appreciate and support and fight for if necessary. Some of the main themes we found in our report, the report is 68 pages long, so I warn you, there is an executive summary, but you know that we don't know enough about IDPs. We need to do a better job of collecting statistics, assessing need, which is fundamental. We need to provide more support to all the host governments. You know, most media attention focuses on refugee camps, particularly in this case, the Zaatari camp in Jordan. But some 80% of the region's refugees aren't in those high visible refugee camps. They're living dispersed in communities, sometimes, you know, putting up a shabby shack or a tent or living with relatives or in a chicken coop behind somebody's house. How do you assist those people? How do you assist refugees without creating resentment on the part of the communities that are hosting them? What about the poor Lebanese and poor Jordanians and, you know, who might see the aid to refugees in terms of resentment? And to just to emphasize the dire need for education. You know, in an emergency situation, most people think of food, water, protection. But education is a protection tool. Kids in school, you know, aren't kids who are on the street working for to support their families or being recruited or getting into trouble or so protection is an important dimension of education. We make a number of recommendations in the report. I'll just highlight a couple. You know, the continued need for humanitarian assistance. You know, if the refugees aren't assisted in neighboring countries, what happens? And I've worked with refugees most of my life, and desperate people do desperate things. If my kids were hungry, I would do a lot of things, including criminal activities, to feed my kids. And it's no different for refugees. You know, it's a security issue as well as a basic humanitarian one. Much more work needs to be done to get access inside Syria. Francois will talk about some of the difficulties of providing assistance in Syria. But in terms of basic humanitarian principles, health workers should not be shot. Ambulances should not be targeted. We've got to find a way to make the regime assume its responsibility toward its own people. The need for development actors to get involved. I heard a term last week, emergency development. You know, traditionally we think humanitarian response, things get stable, then the development actors come in with long-term thinking. But Syria is messing all that up. We need development actors there now. And I'm encouraged by the World Bank's work in Lebanon, for example, to look at the serious long-term needs. And finally, even though so much energy is being mobilized around the immediate Syrian humanitarian crisis, what's going to happen next year? What's going to happen in 5 years? Few people think the war is going to end quickly. Most Syrian refugees want to go home. People want to go home immediately. But what's going to happen in 5 years as displacement drags on? Will the international community be able to provide the $5 billion a year in humanitarian assistance alone? Who's thinking about possible solutions, about things that could be done now that might make eventual return, reconstruction more feasible? It sounds crazy, I know, when the immediate needs are so great, but somebody's got to be thinking long-term about the humanitarian dimension and not just the political and sectarian one. Well, against that somewhat gloomy backdrop, we're going to turn now to Francois to tell us some of ICRC's experiences inside Syria and the particular difficulties or maybe the good things that you're finding.
Thanks, Beth. I'd like to thank you and Brookings for the invite. I also like to thank all of you for taking the time to attend this event. I think it's very important. Syria is, of course, a military and political crisis, but it's also first and foremost a human tragedy. If you agree, I'll just say a few words on our activities in Syria and also on the main challenges that we face, notably in terms of lack of respect for the most basic norms of international humanitarian law and access issues. And then, of course, we'd be happy to have a wider discussion. For the ICRC Syria, today is its largest operation worldwide. We have a budget of $100 million for 2013. We were able to ask and get covered a large budget extension earlier this year. We don't have a money problem for Syria. Our traditional donors have responded very quickly, very generously, the U.S. government first among them, but we also, interestingly, got significant donations from non-traditional donors, such as, for instance, Kuwait, that gave us $25 million, which we found it very, very good. We have 30 permanent international staff based in Syria, about 130 national Syrian staff working with us. Importantly, we have a permanent presence not only in Damascus, but also in Aleppo and Tartus on the sea. We work primarily with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. We'll discuss this later, but the SAARC is our main partner. The SAARC has been designated, as you know, by the authorities as the coordinator for humanitarian aid in Syria. There are obviously risks and costs associated to this approach, but in today's environment, we do believe it's the only viable option if you are to deliver large volumes of assistance inside Syria. We have made the choice as ICRC to work out of Damascus and to try very hard to do cross-line operations so as to reach also those areas under the control of the opposition. Just to keep it simple, there are two possible models if you want to work in Syria. Either you work out of Damascus, you have a relationship with the authorities, you rely on their authorization to move around, and this, I will develop it later, can be bureaucratic and slow. Or you work out of Turkey, you enter Syria from Turkey, and you can work in those areas adjacent to the border under the control of the opposition, but then that would cut you from working in the other areas under the control of the government. So, and these two models are mutually exclusive. You can't do both, because if you enter through Turkey, the government will not deal with you for those areas under the control. So again, the ICRC has been in Syria for many years, mostly related to the issue of the occupation of the Golan, but we were not operational until the current crisis. Our main activities, I will maybe go into the order of success, with the most successful first. We have a massive program in water and habitat, water and sanitation. And I'd like to emphasize this because it's a kind of, it's almost a silent program, but it's a program that works very well. We do cooperate with nine governments, with the water boards of the main cities. We provide the chemicals necessary for ensuring a constant supply of clean drinking waters. We provide spare parts. And as we speak, we have 20 million people inside Syria that still have clean drinking water, access to clean drinking water. And this is very important. The positive thing is that water seems so far not to have been politicized in the Syrian context, which is not the case for other sectors of assistance. We also provide emergency repairs for emergency shelters, for IDPs, although, as you mentioned, like for refugees, most of the IDPs don't stay in collective centers or shelters, but with host families, but still some are in those emergency shelters, which we also help to put together. Food and non-food assistance, it's also a program that is satisfactory. We provide 90,000 food parcels for family per month in nine governments in most areas, including in areas under the control of the opposition. We provide also essential household items to 30,000 families, which means that almost 500,000 persons, food parcels covers 5 persons, almost 500,000 persons receive this food assistance in many different areas of Syria, also primarily with and in cooperation with the Syrian Arab Red Crescent. Health is another important sector. Here things are not going so well. We do provide some assistance, health, medical assistance, especially for the care of war wounded. Not enough. We have been able to provide this assistance for a few thousands of war wounded, but we do, and I will come back to this when I discuss the issue of access, we do face difficulties in moving around with medical material, which seems to be more sensitive than other items. We also support 7 mobile units of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent in Homs, 2 of them, 1 in Hama, in Aleppo, in rural Damascus, in Idlib, and in Tartus. So we have, through the SAARC, also this health capacity to provide assistance to the persons who are victims of the conflict. I would say that the least satisfactory activity, as far as we are concerned, is what we call protection, detention. regretfully, more than 2 years into this conflict, the ICRC is still today, as I speak, unable to visit and assess the conditions of detention of the persons who are being arrested and detained in relation with this conflict. This is a major disappointment. It remains a big priority. We will never give up. We will always keep high level and also level at Damascus discussion to have this, but we don't have received so far the necessary clearance and guarantees to engage into this activity. We did, I think, early, maybe more than 1 year ago, 2 visits, and then the activity got blocked. You know that the ICRC can be very demanding when it visits persons deprived of freedom. We must, of course, have the opportunity to conduct interviews without any witnesses with the persons detained. We must also be able to report on their conditions of detention. We must be able to register them, to allow them to communicate with their families. And if those conditions are not met, we will simply not engage into this activity. On the opposition side, we also so far have not yet received the necessary guarantees to engage into a long-term detention activities, but we are also, of course, working on that side. So detention protection, it is so far not satisfactory, not at all, I would say, but it remains very high on our priority list. In summary, in terms of activities, there is still a lot we can do in terms of assistance. Thanks also to the generous financial support we have received. So we can have this assistance machine that provides a lot of goods to many people, but we should remain, I think, very humble. Needs are not met in Syria, very far from it. I think that's maybe the one thing everybody agrees on. There are many unmet humanitarian needs in Syria as we speak, despite the fact that you have actors like us working out of Damascus and other actors working out of Turkey. So clearly more should be done. In terms of issues, so I mentioned briefly in my introduction, we see in Syria, regrettably, a widespread disregard for the most basic norms of international humanitarian law, especially when it comes to the protection of the medical mission. We thought that things like occupation of health facilities by combatants, with the result that, of course, they are regularly targeted, combatants searching medical facilities, interrupting medical treatments, killing enemy patients, these things happen. Obviously, we took for granted that you don't shoot on the ambulance, and regretfully, we were wrong. I mean, it came also as a surprise to many in the ICRC to see how bad this particular aspect of respecting the most basic norm that have been, I mean, IHL, International Humanitarian Law, is a body of law that is 150 years old, but it rests on various codes and laws that are much more ancient, present in all cultures. I mean, and you would imagine that these very basic norms would be respected. Regretfully, this is not the case. We also have health staff threatened, arrested, or killed sometimes because, again, treating the other side. We have public and private health facilities very much affected by a strong decrease in qualified staff. A lot of qualified staff has left Syria because their work was becoming impossible. We have also vaccination campaigns that have been interrupted for over 2 years now in some areas. And also, while this figure of 100,000 dead draw a lot of attention, these are the direct people, the direct casualties, people who have been shot, who have met a rapid end usually. But what is also very disturbing is that I think there is agreement that even more people in Syria have died following chronic diseases because of unaddressed needs in their chronic diseases, because of diabetes, because of heart disease. Treatment is becoming unavailable or is becoming far more expensive and they can't afford it. So this is also, we see an explosion in the number of deaths of following chronic diseases. And this is usually unreported because, of course, it's less visible than people who are simply shot at or killed by a bombing. The other problem, challenge, is access. Very difficult. Despite the situation, the government remains bureaucratic, remains slow. It's very formal. You need to send authorization. You need authorization to move around the country, to move goods around the country. This takes time. It is still very, very much organized. And we do, as I said, have access to some opposition-held areas, notably to provide food assistance, but there are also opposition-held areas to which we have no access. And clearly, we are now also in our negotiations in Damascus pushing for a better access to all affected areas. This is especially true for medical assistants, as I said, medical furniture, which seems to be, they seem to be a greater reluctance. It's more difficult to get the clearance to move those kind of assistants across the line than simply food. On the other side, it's not easy either. The opposition is fragmented, as you know, many different groups. It's very difficult to create a lasting dialogue to obtain the necessary guarantees that your convoys will not be attacked, will be safe, that you will be able to go through the lines to deliver this assistance. We engage at different levels with the opposition, first, of course, in person, in places like Aleppo. We try and actively go and meet with these groups to explain who we are, to explain what we do, to explain how we work, no armed escorts, the Red Cross, the modalities of our work, to make sure that this is understood and accepted. We also have many occasions at the numerous checkpoints that now dot the whole landscape, but this is also an illustration of the challenge. I mean, these checkpoints are moving. The people who hold the checkpoints are also new, so you have a constant change of key interlocutors. So it is also very difficult. We have a third level via Skype. It sounds interesting, but yes, we have also a dialogue with some more senior people, commanders, who are either in Turkey or in Syria or in other places, who also can engage via Skype or other means of telecommunication to try again to explain the nature of our operation, how we work, and to try and seek the necessary security guarantees. We also have a challenge with criminality. Criminality is becoming an issue. And obviously, there are also some groups now that are very radical that would possibly be hostile to an association, to an organization like the ICRC. And our challenge is that it's difficult for us to engage, as we would like to do, with these groups because we don't get always the necessary authorization from Damascus to go and meet with them. So it's a kind of a negative vicious circle in the sense that you don't have the necessary authorization to go and meet with them on a regular basis, which prevents you from engaging into a dialogue that would allow, hopefully, to be better understood and to go there. So access, I think, takes most of the time of my colleagues in Syria. And it is not all black. Again, there are many things we can do. But clearly, given the size and the extent of the damage, of the suffering, we'd like to have more. Access is, of course, also difficult because of the inherent risks of a conflict. I mean, it is a war. I mean, you have shooting, you have snipers, you have bombs. We accept those risks. We know about those risks. The SAARC has paid a very heavy toll to this conflict. 22 SAARC staff have been killed while carrying out their duties. We've had also some close escape. We've had cars shot at, hit. So it is a risk we accept, and we accept that when there is active fighting, we will not try and go just there. Still, we do believe that there are situations and there were cases and places at times when we think we could have gone and provided assistance when we did not receive the necessary authorization. The obvious example is Ghouta, the place that became very famous on August 21st because of the chemical attack, where the previous 6 months all ICRC requests to go there were turned down. Then you had the weapons inspector who were authorized to go there, but our requests were still being turned down while the weapons inspector were going there. And obviously no severe fighting was there. So again, to highlight the issue of access. So I think I will stop here. I think for us, yes, it's really disrespect of the most basic norm, which is a grave concern, and also this access issue that we are working on.
Thank you, Francois, and also thank ICRC for the incredible work you're doing in these circumstances. Salman, we'll turn to you now to look at some of the political dimensions of this dire, grim, depressing situation in Syria.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. It's nice to be in the room rather than via satellite or Skype or something from Doha, and to be in the same time zone as you. I'll confine my remarks to in sort of two, three bits, I guess. One, in terms of the regional states and the humanitarian impact that they're having to deal with and the burdens they're having to deal with. A little bit about the political, though you'll have to stop me because I could go on all day ranting about that, and mix in with that a little bit with regards to the role of the Gulf actors, and maybe we can expand on that in the Q&A. First thing I'd like to say, of course, is that it's been a pleasure working with you, Beth, and Kamal in this particular report, and we look forward to continuing that that cooperation. As we were writing and as I was reading and rereading the report, of course, the thing that struck me, and it will strike you, and even the statistics some of you have already seen, is just the sheer scale of human misery that this report paints. In fact, I had to close the report a couple of times, and I have a guy who's seen a hell of a lot of things, in whether working for the UN previously, whether in Africa or other parts of the Middle East. Unfortunately, the Middle East and the Syrian crisis now adds to it, is a region now of the permanently displaced, from the Palestinian refugees to Iraqis and others. And, you know, this is a burden which, you know, this region is taking on, which could well do without. In terms of the regional side of things, of course, the first thing we should say is that the governments in the region, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Iraq, and Egypt, all deserve credit and appreciation for opening their borders, by and large, and for hosting something like 2 million refugees now since the start of the Syrian conflict, and many, many more who have moved across because they can, because of, they've got the means at least to go and set up home elsewhere. This, of course, has, as I said, placed a huge burden on host governments, not only in financial terms, but also in terms of maintaining national security, their own political stability, and preserving the delicate ethnic and sectarian balances within their own countries. We can talk a little bit more about that, but when we refer to Turkey or Lebanon or Iraq, you know what I'm talking about. And it seems as if this crisis is only going to get worse. As Beth, you said, I don't foresee this coming to an end anytime soon. In fact, we might be at another phase where the conflict intensifies. I'll give one statistic to you. In Geneva 1, the time of Geneva 1, there were about 40,000 refugees. There are now 2 million. And this is Geneva, whatever you call it, 1.5 or 1-point detour or something. And the likelihood is that we're going to see, in my view, an exponential rise of people who are affected by increased fighting. Something I can come back to. Specific countries, I'd focus a bit on, because of time, just Lebanon and Jordan. Kamal is here, and I'm sure he can say a few comments on Turkey. And we can discuss Iraq as well. But let me just quickly focus on Lebanon and Jordan. Of course, the 2012 Baghdad Declaration, Lebanon, the dissociation policy, which was supposed to keep Lebanese actors politically out of this, has really not worked, with Hezbollah's involvement, but also of Sunni groups who have used Lebanon as a back base for the fighting. We've also seen, of course, the growing presence of refugees and asylum seekers and ebbs and flows. You can, as you said, just before the threat of U.S. strikes, we had probably 8,000, 10,000 people coming across the border into Lebanon. What are some of the effects of this? Well, of course, I hate to use this word because the Middle East is not just about sectarianism, but there are sectarian tensions, especially as Beth said, with Sunni, by and large, Sunni refugees settling in sometimes Shia strongholds, such as in the Bekaa Valley or in the south, as well as in the north. There are deteriorating security conditions. A recent poll amongst Lebanese found that 52% of them believe that Syrian refugees pose a threat to national security and stability. And more than 90% said that the Syrian conflict has had a negative impact on the Lebanese government's capacities to protect Lebanese citizens and government. Lebanese, as you know, are extremely generous people. But nevertheless, the strains are showing. And even this despite, of course, Lebanese well remember how Syrians hosted so many of their people at the time of the 2006 conflict. And then, of course, the economic duress that many are feeling. Unemployment is on the rise, increased competition over jobs, wages are being undercut, and this is only likely to continue. There's, of course, overcrowding. Some towns in the Bekaa Valley in the north have reported up to 100% increases in their population over the last 2 years. The situation is also very bad in Beirut. Rents are allegedly going up 300-400% for those who can afford it. Schools and health centers are increasingly overwhelmed. And as I said, there is no doubt in my mind that the flow of refugees will continue. We still haven't had the battle for Damascus, but it will come. And here we're talking about 2 million people in Damascus. And we've already had a small indication of that, as I said, with the threat of airstrikes, of people moving increasingly across. Let me turn to Jordan for a second. Damascus, of course, is less than 200 kilometers from Amman. I've done this often when I worked for the UN. In fact, it was a pleasure to take that drive. The Jordanian border is even less, about 60, 70 kilometers away. And of course, you've all heard about Za'atari Camp, which you've documented very well in one of your previous reports, fourth largest city in Jordan now, over 120,000 people. And within that, of course, increasing concerns about security and the like. Then, turning to security itself, of course, there are concerns about deteriorating security conditions in Jordan, threat of extremism. Jordanians remember very well 2005, around the Iraq War, when they had suicide bombers blowing themselves up in Jordanian Amman hotels. So this is a very real threat that they face. And then, of course, the economic malaise as well. In parts of northern Jordan, Syrian refugees make up more than half of the local populations. Widespread, I think, growing resentment against some of the refugees. And some, I wouldn't say blanket, resentment when it comes to the shortages of food. There's certainly water shortages, electricity, and things like that, some which we document in the report. Apparently, there's about 160,000 Syrians who hold jobs in Jordan, many of them, again, probably being paid wages which are less than half of what Jordanians would. As I said, I will leave the Turkish part to Kamal, but there also are concerns about the effects that refugees are having with regards to the delicate ethnic and social balance of the southeastern part of Turkey itself. Even though the Turks have been incredible hosts in assuming so much of the financial burden. One idea that we present in our conclusions is perhaps it's time collectively to support these countries. What about the World Bank or others putting together an Arab states or neighboring states stabilization fund, a pot of money which also Gulf states and others who have the cash can contribute to, but which can be administered in the right way, with the right technical expertise and know-how. That is urgently needed, and it can be as far as Egypt, which is also assuming a huge burden in terms of refugees and the like. Let me now turn just to the political side of things. Of course, the humanitarian crisis we're talking about is a direct outcome of the failure of the international community to help solve the main problem, the political crisis in Syria. And as long as we don't have a political solution in Syria, this humanitarian crisis, I've been saying, is likely only to get worse. And particularly, I would say, the failure of the international community to press, or first and foremost, of course, for the regime to protect its civilians, and then for the international community to do what it should be doing in order to protect civilians inside Syria. And yet, a political solution, which in my view and which has been expressed by President Obama and others, is a transition to a new power-sharing formula in Syria, which is minus Assad and those immediately around him. And yet, that seems to be quite far off. You now have, we've had this big debate. I was fortunate enough to arrive just as it sort of was kicking off last week within Congress and all the rest of it. You've had now this Geneva agreement, and now you're in the UN Security Council, all on the issue of chemical weapons, which is, as many of us would acknowledge, the tip of the iceberg in terms of what civilians are having to go through on a daily basis. And by the way, let me just note, in that period up to Geneva for the previous 10 days or so, there were no regime aircraft bombing their people. They started 2-3 days ago. And we're on the ground, we're seeing increasing intensification of the conflict again around Damascus in the north and elsewhere. So there is a direct correlation here. We are now, as I said, in the UN Security Council, and yet what we're likely to see here is a long struggle. Don't expect a UN Security Council resolution anytime soon. I just came back from New York last night. It will probably be left to the principals who are all coming for the UN high-level jamboree of world leaders to discuss. The hope is that it can be done and dusted by then, but the big issue here, of course, is Chapter 7 and the enforcement of what the international community wants. And, of course, from the comments, I would say the dismaying comments we've been hearing from Moscow over the last 24 hours or so, it doesn't seem as if we're going to have an easy understanding in terms of that. In fact, there is the Russians are now saying and criticizing the UN inspector's report itself, which they were holding in high regard, and also saying that this is not necessarily for the UN Security Council at this point to deal with in a robust fashion. We have to go through this OPCW, the chemical weapons body, in order to enforce this kind of thing. This is going to take time. And by the way, let me just say one thing on the Russian position. Some people I heard this morning on the radio saying they're backsliding. In fact, they're not backsliding. They're exactly where they were. They don't want to put further pressure on Bashar al-Assad and put that threat of the use of force. And yet, what we know, tactically, what has worked over the last few days, maybe we stumbled upon it, was to have a clear goal, coerce pressure, and if necessary, build the necessary coalition for enforcement. That's the only language, I'm afraid, that this regime understands. And that's why we had UN inspectors in the East Ghouta suburbs within 5 days, whereas it took them 5 months to get into Syria in terms of negotiations. What does this mean? In my view, this does not mean that a political solution is any closer, just around this chemical weapons issue. Geneva 2, even though discussions are going to intensify to get that going next week at the UN, I don't anticipate in this climate that this is going to happen anytime soon. In parallel, as I've said, what we are going to see is an intensification of the conflict. We're also going to see, in my view, rising regional tensions. What we've seen in Turkey over the last couple of days, I think, is a forebearer of things to come. Whilst, again, Kamal can talk more, whilst the Turks have been holding back to the kind of attacks that they've faced, I don't think that's going to necessarily hold forever. I think we're going to see now a tit-for-tat between the Assad regime and the Turks, which could lead to a greater escalation. And here, of course, let me remind you that Turkey is a member of NATO. And what does this mean? And what kind of a headache is this going to pose for President Obama in particular? Again, it underscores the point. One cannot manage the effects of this crisis. You have to do your absolute best to help Syrians resolve it. And that means taking increasingly tougher and tougher decisions in an increasingly complicated environment. I said this 2 years ago. Well, we are now where we are in that respect. And then, of course, we're going to see that the humanitarian situation, as I said, intensify. You know, the humanitarian situation, particularly if we talk about the ethnic and social balance of Lebanon or Iraq even, or Turkey, it's a ticking time bomb. And in many ways, it has been presented that way by the regime. This number of people in such fragile countries like Lebanon does have consequences, and we're seeing that. Finally, let me just say, and then I think I should stop, the Gulf states. First of all, the Gulf states, I think, should be commended because they have been at the forefront of trying to support the Syrians. First and foremost, politically, there was an effort to try, if you remember, led by the GCC to take this issue into the Arab League, where the Arab League, incredibly, again, suspended a member, and then there was resolutions that then pushed it to the UN Security Council. That was a political script that they followed, very similar to the one that we saw in Libya. But unfortunately, unlike Libya, we didn't get unanimity, we didn't get consensus within the Security Council, and that's where we got stuck. The Gulf states' role then has been, I guess, more controversial, including after, I think, about 8 or 9 months of this conflict, helping the militarization of the conflict. But let me say, the conflict was militarized from day two when Assad's forces started to shoot at unarmed protesters. Nevertheless, the Gulf states have been increasingly angst-ridden, concerned about providing more support, but also about the lack of U.S. leadership in this regard. And I would say to you that their efforts have not entirely always been successful. In fact, to a certain degree, what Qatar or Saudi Arabia and others have been doing has contributed to the fragmentation that we see now on the ground inside Syria. But this is where, in my view, U.S. leadership and support is so absolutely essential, and which they've been asking for. This latest episode that we've seen around the whole chemical weapons issue, I think, and what they now perceive as great reluctance from President Obama to really to get involved, and which they translate as also showing a lack of resolve, which will only encourage the Assad regime, I'm afraid, may well take not just the Gulf states, but other regional actors to start taking more and more decisions by themselves, which, again, will add a further fuel to the conflict that I am talking about. And here I also put, again, Turkey in that particular frame. What is undoubtedly needed, as I keep saying, is U.S. leadership. If we're to lay the foundations of the transition, and that really should be the goal, whether it's in military terms, in political terms, or in humanitarian redevelopment terms, you need a more joined-up strategy led by capable leaders. And, of course, in my view, in that respect, the U.S. is still the indispensable leader regarding this.
Thank you very much, and thanks to both of you. Before we open it up to questions, let me just ask you a couple of things. We haven't heard much about the role of Syrian civil society groups. You mentioned SARC, but isn't it true that Syrian groups and diaspora groups are really playing the leading role inside Syria in terms of providing assistance? And then, Salman, if you want to say something about the opposition, how well are they doing at assisting people in territories that they control? Can we start with you?
Yeah, maybe about the SAC. I mean, the SAC is a very important partner for us, as I've said, and I think we can be candid and admit, yes, they have come under criticism for being too close to the regime, and understandably so, because any Red Cross or Red Crescent society will be organically close to its authorities. Now, the ICRC has made a strategic choice to actually cooperate with the SAC and try to improve their independence. And let me say that, SARC, as again any national Red Cross, Red Crescent society, is very close, is a reflection of its population. And in those areas where the opposition is dominant, you also have people working for SARC who are from this region who would share the same feelings. And so we have, for instance, in Homs, in Aleppo, we also have volunteers who you really can't say they are close to the regime. And again, as I said, 22 staff killed while carrying their duty. They have paid a heavy price. They are really, I think the motivation of their staff really cannot be questioned. And for us, besides, had we chosen to stay away from them, that would have really pushed them into the arms of the government. They would have nowhere else to go. So we have chosen, despite some early criticism, and I'm happy to see that this criticism has mostly subsided in recent months. So we have worked very hard, and we continue to work very hard at convincing them and helping them develop independence from the government. And I think they understand it's also for their reputation, for their safety, for their security. So we remain absolutely convinced that the net outcome of our cooperation with SAC is clearly positive, especially if you look at the volume of assistance that goes through, mostly through them.
I think they have over 10,000 volunteers
yes,
who are involved in delivering the assistance.
Yes, yes.
Salman, what about the opposition? How good a job are they doing at delivering assistance?
Not very well. I won't tell you exactly where I went, but where I went recently inside Syria, I mean, there really isn't any real opposition mechanism here. There are efforts through local NGOs, and maybe those are being supported to a certain degree by the opposition ACU to deliver assistance. But you really don't have a coherent, coordinated opposition presence in even the north and the east of the country, the so-called liberated areas. And, of course, that is also impacting in terms of the political credibility of the opposition. That's not to say that they can't do it, and it's absolutely essential. And, of course, the opposition has now elected a new sort of interim or transitional prime minister, whose job it will be to work to establish those kinds of systems and mechanisms to support the local populations. But by and large, it's being done in an ad hoc way. It's being done by local councils, incredibly brave and capable people, but it's also being done in pockets by more extremist groups like Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS. And we speak to some of the tribal folks, for example, in the northeast of the country, and there are clear pockets where you have ISIS or Jabhat al-Nusra controlling territory, getting revenue from oil and the selling of oil, collusion with the regime because they're selling it to the regime. They're getting millions of Syrian pounds worth of revenue almost on a weekly basis, and then they're controlling the relief and the aid to particular areas. That's not a situation which can be allowed to continue. The opposition, I'm afraid, has to do a much better job, but it also has to do a much better job politically. It still does not present that broad-based Syrian national platform which Syrians can recognize themselves in. And until it does so, it will always present a shaky foundation for a future transition.
Thank you. Before opening up, and this has been somewhat depressing, let me ask you what your best case scenario is. Yes.
Well, I mean, this is a very large crisis that requires a political solution. And again, you know, I've spent many years working in former Yugoslavia in the 90s, and I feel somehow the same creepy feeling of kind of pressure on us, on other emergent actors, to come up with a solution. When the international diplomatic political committee is desperate, I mean, you feel this pressure as a humanitarian. Please come up with a solution. And this is simply not something we can do. Donors can be very demanding of us when it comes to increase our assistance volume, to increase our access. This is all fair. But do not be demanding of asking a political solution. This is not what the Humanitarian Committee will do. And I hope that this Kerry Lavrov meeting on the strikes will lead maybe to a Geneva, something between 1.5 and 2 or further, and that, yes, there will be a political settlement. You know, I'd just like to say for the ICRC, it's striking. We lament somehow the lack of mobilization of the diplomatic community, not only for Syria, but for many other conflicts. You would imagine the ICRC rushes into new conflicts and addresses emerging new needs. But if you look at our top 10 operations, with the exception of Syria, these are all places where we've been for 20, 30 years, which says a lot about the lack of resolve in solving those conflicts. So, yes, we can keep providing assistance. We can keep treating war wounded. But that's not going to do it. And I think more should be done politically, clearly.
Thank you. Salman, best case scenario.
I can make a couple of recommendations, which I guess are built on more positive sort of ideals, but which I believe are not unrealistic. Firstly, in terms of humanitarian action, I think we need to do a much better job of, given the situation where it is, of trying to draw in a broader array of countries to be interested and to pressure those who are stopping the kind of action that we need in consenting to cross, in supporting cross-border action as well as cross-line and providing the kind of assistance. And that means the other BRICS. You know, it's time Brazil, India, you know, South Africa, others start putting pressure on some of their other member states. It's time that the 120-member non-aligned movement within the UN, it's a powerful block, starts to put pressure on those who are holding up clear, purposeful humanitarian action inside and outside the country, as well as the financial support. And I believe that we are probably a little bit closer to that, but that needs to be pressed now. And I think sustained and determined diplomacy on the part of those who want this thing to be unblocked now needs to take place. We shouldn't. I know I'm a former UN guy, and I know we're all very disappointed with the UN, but we can't still turn our back on those kinds of multilateral venues for pressing this. And I hope that around the UN General Assembly, that will be a major issue. The other recommendation, or the other belief I have, is actually a political solution is possible, and ultimately it will be possible. Why? Because I've come across and I've talked, and I've been looking at Syria for many years. Syrian society and the Syrian people are fundamentally Syrians first. They are not people who are extremists. They are not people who are sectarian in their outlook, first and foremost. But given this particular crisis, there is now a dire need to help them to forge a new set of power-sharing formulas and agreements between themselves. And it's come to a point where they do need that assistance. You know, it's something remarkable. We at the center run a lot of track to dialogues. We engage with a lot of different Syrians from different backgrounds. And it's remarkable when you listen to those from different communities, from, I hate to use the word minority and majority, but those from minority communities as well as those from the Sunni community, when you listen to different constituencies, whether it's the business and economic elites, or whether it's the tribal leaderships and others, or the religious leaders, it's remarkable how they start to now express their interests, but also show a willingness to negotiate those interests that they have, whether it's to do with their own security, their economic well-being, whether it's to do with property rights. And yet, we haven't provided, in my view, the international community the kind of support that needs to be. We have become more and more hesitant about running those track two dialogues. Why? Because we can't protect these people. We bring them out of Damascus or elsewhere, the regime catches up with them pretty quickly. And this is the problem. This is why the international community now has a responsibility to create a legitimate, credible international space whereby which Syrians can try to forge those understandings and those agreements. Only then will we lay the foundations for the kind of political solution that we're all looking for. And I go back to this point. Our biggest hope here is actually the Syrian people themselves. This is not Iraq. This is not Lebanon in that context. I believe that Syrians, if we are able to get the right group of people, will be able to forge these kinds of understandings, and they'll be very, very important and useful to us. I don't believe in a regime opposition dialogue necessarily. Both of these two camps don't necessarily represent the majority of Syrians today, and I'm afraid that's the sad reality.
Thank you very much. We'll open it up now for questions. We have microphones. Maybe we'll take three or four at a time. We'll go one, two. Start with those two. And maybe while we're waiting, Kamal, if you could stand up. This is Kamal Qureshi, who wrote the Turkish part of our report. And if you have questions about, stand up, Kamal. Come on, come on. So if you have questions about Turkey, he can certainly handle them. But let's begin with this gentleman here. If you could identify yourself.
Yes, I'm Ari Waters. This comprehensive report is very interesting and very helpful. The argument or the view that a political involvement and settlement has to be done before we can get anywhere, I think is the necessary but insufficient part of it, because we just saw what happened in Britain and the U.S. The British Parliament overturned the Prime Minister. The United States is not getting support. Obama's not getting support for the American public. So the question I'm raising is, what program and what efforts are being made to direct your concerns and your reports to the public generally, through churches, through educational institutions, through business communities, whatever, in order to swell that background of support which the political leaders have to have in order to be successful?
Thank you very much. Besma?
Hi, Besma Momeli at Brookings and professor at the University of Waterloo. I'm just wondering whether you could comment on the difference between the official camps that are being created in Jordan versus the lack of camps in Lebanon, specifically how different it is and what are the challenges or opportunities. Some have even sort of claimed that that's probably a positive thing in Lebanon, although I have my doubts on that. What does that pose for the refugees themselves? Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Another question or two before we turn to responses. We have one. One here and then one in the back, and then we'll have a chance for responses.
My name's Deb Friedman. You asked about the how well the opposition was doing in providing aid. I was wondering how well the U.S. is doing in providing aid.
Okay, and one last question there in the back.
My name is Michelle Strzok. I'm with the Syrian American Medical Society, SAMS. My question is, I see one of the recommendations is to have a U.N. Security Council resolution on cross-border assistance. I know that would help reach a lot of different areas of Syria that currently the ICRC and others can't reach. Could you comment basically on how there might be opportunities now, given the Security Council action, to get a resolution about cross-border assistance or safe passage for humanitarian aid workers in the case that they're working to protect chemical weapons inspectors but maybe not humanitarian aid workers. Thank you.
Okay, so we have four questions in terms of engaging the public, official versus camps versus lack of camps. How well is the U.S. doing on aid, Security Council resolution on cross-border? You want to tackle any of these? First one who jumps in gets to pick which questions to respond to.
Well, maybe I'll take the first one as a non-American. Let me try. Sarah, I agree. There needs to be a much greater effort to be able to reach really grassroots American opinion shapers. That's extremely important. But the number one responsibility here lies with your president. President Obama started directly speaking to his people on Syria about a week and a half ago. This conflict has been going on for 30 months. He needs to do a much better job, in my view, in having a conversation and in leading that conversation with the American people. Because understandably, for all the reasons that he himself has laid out, you have an American public, understandably, which is incredibly war-weary. It also believes that this Middle East is just a beehive of trouble. And whatever we do, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. Look at what happened in Libya. We understand all of that. But there is something which is unspeakable going on in this place called Syria, in the heart of the Middle East. It is unspeakable. And unfortunately, evil does not have a particular convenient timing. And this is why this president, who I used to, when I was in Doha, I used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to listen to his speeches and the campaign trail. This was a transformational president, and yet he's facing the biggest challenge of his presidency. And as I wrote last week, if we're not careful, this issue is going to follow his presidency for every single day until it ends in 3 years' time.
Now, we also wonder how much worse does it have to go before there is really this distraction. And it's pretty much the same in Europe. I mean, it's very difficult to get this traction, this concern from the public that could then apply pressure on their parliaments and executives. It's simply surprising. It was, of course, a lot of attention on Syria the last 2 weeks, but that was mostly about the possible U.S. strikes, and we couldn't help but notice that there was absolutely no consideration on the possible humanitarian effect of this strike. It was all about strategic, surgical, these kind of things, the political implications on the regime. So, yeah, it's kind of a mystery. Maybe there is this fatigue, but we noticed that it's very difficult. For us, for instance, we cannot get a clear statement at the highest level for the most basic respect of international humanitarian law, which seems to be a very reachable common denominator with all the major powers on this planet. Nobody is against those rules. I mean, every country in the nation, on the planet, has signed to these rules, and we simply can't get there. So it's surprising and very disappointing. We keep trying, but it's very hard not only to get the interest of the public, but further up of the governments too. We do get the money, yes, we are grateful for that, but indeed, if we want to go further and to actually resolve the problem, much more must be done politically, and it takes political muscle and political willingness, and we don't really see it there at the moment. And again, how much worse does it have to get? But it's pretty awful as it is now.
And maybe I'll respond very briefly to some of these comments. First, on the question of public engagement, public fundraising for Syrian refugees has done very badly. I mean, it's much easier for ordinary people to contribute to victims of a natural disaster than a complex political conflict. You know, one out of two Americans contributed to Haiti, which is amazing. But the amount of money being raised through private public fundraising is very low in the case of Syria. In terms of official camps versus non-camps, the general thinking in the humanitarian world is that people are better off outside of camps. Camps have many bad repercussions. And yet in situations such as Lebanon, where there are no camps and there just isn't enough housing and people are camping on the streets and in empty fields, I think there is a need and a role for camps. At least in camps, health services can be made available and you can check on distribution. You can find out who the vulnerable people are. So I think particularly in Lebanon, there is a push to have camps. I think the U.S. has done a terrific job in terms of its aid to Syrian refugees, displaced people, both in terms of the financial contributions, now over $1 billion, but also in terms of very creative ways of trying to get aid inside Syria by working with many Syrian groups and doing kinds of operations they don't talk about much publicly. But I think the commitment has been outstanding. I don't think the Security Council can come up with a strong enough resolution on the questions of humanitarian access. If you look at the case of Bosnia and you stack up the Security Council resolutions, almost all of them were strong on humanitarian access and protecting humanitarian workers and respecting international norms. And if you compare that with what's happening on Syria, it's almost embarrassing. We recommend that for the GA, the General Assembly, to be much more active. If the Security Council can't come up with strong resolutions, then the will of the majority of the world's countries, we think, is to make sure that people in need get the assistance they need. And frankly, I don't think there's any, you know, pushing the Syrian regime to eliminate some of these bureaucratic obstacles. Why does it take months to get a UN staff to renew a visa or to import medicines or bring in a vehicle? Those are bureaucratic administrative things that can be fixed quickly and in a less political way than some of these questions of crossing opposition lines. But I think, you know, the government needs to be held to account for this.
Mm-hmm. No, but just you talk about Bosnia. Yeah, there were resolutions, but before those resolutions, there was also a very active and forceful dialogue at many levels in many different places. Heads were knocked together, and then, yes, we had this, and this is what is absent. Syria is a context with an absence of solutions today, and this is tragic.
Can I just say, regarding the Bosnian experience as well, I was with Prince Said of Jordan, who's got tremendous experience on this side, the Jordanian ambassador to the UN, and, you know, he was involved at the time. There's a whole body of experience which was learnt at that time, including by the UN, and I think perhaps we need to do a better job of capturing that experience institutionally as well as to how one deals with it. But also, in this case, we are still assuming that the authority of the Syrian government is paramount, it's central. Well, if you look at the country, that's not the case. So if we are not able to get a UN Security Council resolution, as we're saying, we need to go for a wider endorsement by the General Assembly, but also start to do much more ourselves off the back of that.
And in Bosnia, the bad guys were part of the dialogue.
Okay, other questions? I guess we have one, two, three.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Ben Kalt. I'm from SAIS. My question is about access. It sounds like there's very uneven access, that the access to the regime-held areas is fairly good and not to the opposition-held areas. So I'm just wondering, is this international aid, in a sense, subsidizing the regime and undermining the legitimacy of the opposition? And how do you, what's your take on that dilemma? I mean, the alternative of denying aid completely is obviously unthinkable, but still seems major.
Thank you very much. And there was another gentleman. Yes.
Uh-huh. I'm Ford Copeland with NATO's Civil Military Relations Center. I have a follow-up question about camps in Lebanon. Is there any indication that the Lebanese government will change its policy on camps? And would that do anything to mitigate potential insecurities, spillover violence in the region?
Thank you. Can you answer?
Hi, I'm Ramsey Fisher. I'm from American University. At the beginning, you were talking about a long-term solution, how in 5 years from now we're going to see these problems reoccur. My question has to do with the children of Syria. I was reading many articles about this, but a lot of journalists are calling this generation a lost generation. They've been out of school. A lot of them have been displaced. What can the international community, in particular the U.S., in particular, do to mitigate this lost generation, and how severe is that going to turn out?
Okay. One more question before we turn to our panelists. Okay, I have this young woman here.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Colby Wilkinson from the American Red Cross. I had a question about how, is there any possibility for the humanitarian organizations to now take advantage of the access that weapons inspectors have gained to certain areas that organizations have not been able to obtain before?
Okay, thank you. Would you like to maybe start on some of the questions about access? And
yes. Mm-hmm. It's a fair question. It's not the first time we are being asked this. I mean, first, it's not like opposition held areas, regime held areas, you have a clean cut border in between the two. It's a shifting border and it's not so clearly delineated. But it is true that we struggle to have regular access to opposition held areas. We do have access to some of those areas, I'd like to emphasize this, but it is not satisfactory and we are pushing for more. Now let me assure you that the people we assist in the regime control areas are also in absolute need of assistance. And this, we have direct control on those persons. We see the beneficiaries. We talk to them. So it's not like we don't hand over the assistance to the government. It's really to beneficiaries. I think everybody will tell you that Syria has been shaken so much that the needs are pretty much everywhere. So, yes, we'd like to cover more areas, but we are very confident that the areas we cover, even including those controlled by the government, are perfectly legitimate, needy people following the consequence of the conflict. So, but I agree that, yes, we try and we push to have more regular access, especially for medical furnitures, to those other areas. For the weapon inspector, I don't know. My personal take would be that we should stay away from this because it will be highly politicized. I think if you imagine weapon inspector, I mean, you remember that the first time they tried, they were hit by snipers. It would be the perfect opportunity to create an incident. Many different factions could have an interest, or even the government could have an interest in those weapon inspectors running into some kind of problem. So, yes, I hope that the fact that we have regular weapon inspector visits in Syria in the future could contribute to a general ease of the current conflictual situation. But I would never associate humanitarian sorties, if you wish, with those weapon inspectors sorties. I think we should de-link the two things very clearly.
Salman, you want to respond to any of these?
First, on the, I agree with regards to the inspectors. And, you know, a UN colleague was telling me, former colleague was telling me that in order for those inspectors to go somewhere, they sometimes had to negotiate, even at that point, with about 40 different commanders whilst they were doing this. So it's an extremely complex situation. That was just in and around Damascus. So I would prefer to keep the two separate as well for all sorts of humanitarian principles. I mean, I think there needs to be much more focus, though, again, on humanitarian corridors and even, I would say, safe zones or safe areas. You have de facto areas where IDPs and others are now congregated along borders, for example, and also in certain communities, for example, in the south, in Sueda, which is a largely Druze area. They have been trying desperately to keep this as a safe area where everyone's welcome, where people get relief and support, but you know, no fighting and all of that is largely allowed, or they've been trying. They've got very little support in doing that, and yet this was a result of an internal community consultation which led to them taking this stance some time ago. Can I just say about Lebanon and the fact that they didn't go for the camps now that they are thinking about it, it's very tricky for them because of the experience that they had with the Palestinians. And just a few days ago we had the Sabra and Shatila anniversary as well. They don't want to make permanent another community, and yet that is what is likely the case. And in fact, I'd say probably in Lebanon, I was listening to a Lebanese official the other day, he's estimating that probably approaching close to half the country could be Syrian in the next few months. We just don't know to that extent. And of course, why? Because of that special history and relationship that Lebanon and Syria have. There is no real border. There's a dotted line that separates Lebanon and Syria. And that's always, you know, as it has been. The international community after 2006, for example, in that conflict, try to put in and assist in some sort of a border regime. But to all intents and purposes, you know, it hasn't really been able to. So Lebanon is facing the consequences now of what's going on.
There's some discussion now in Lebanon about setting up what would be called transit camps, and I understand that sites have actually been identified, you know, making it clear that these are temporary. I think they would increase the security both of the refugees and indeed of the country if, you know, rather than having refugees now in Lebanon living in over 1,400 different places, makes it difficult for UN or anyone to keep track or visit or provide assistance and so on. In terms of the question about Syria's children, I mean, maybe I'm an optimist, but I hate to think that we're at a point now where we can talk about a lost generation. And it may be that issues around children and education might be more useful as a way of mobilizing public support. I mean, Americans can identify with kids who need to go to school and parents who have kids at home and are worried about them. Maybe, you know, that might be a way of raising more public awareness and not getting involved in some of the politics, but just meeting the sheer needs of kids who need to go to school, who want to go to school. These are not easy issues. When we were in Lebanon, for example, we were told that even though children and refugee children are allowed to go to schools in Lebanon, there were lots of problems. The language of instruction in Lebanon was different than Arabic. It was English and French. The kids were really traumatized, that parents didn't have money for transportation, that class sizes were an issue. You can imagine a Lebanese school teacher used to having 30 or 40 kids, suddenly having 80, half of them speaking in a different language, all of them traumatized. You know, there are lots of practical considerations that funding and awareness might do something to alleviate. Any other questions? Yes, I have one, two, three, and then perhaps Kamal, if you'd like to say something about Turkey. Start your one.
Question to.
If you could identify yourself.
Yeah. My name is Mohammed Nimer. I'm a professor at the American University. Question to Francois. If I'm not mistaken, the opposition actually, although things are shifting, but the opposition at least claims to have control of much of the country. And much of the destruction and death and displacement is happening in that part of the country. What made you decide to work with the government in delivering assistance?
Just trying to understand
there's need there too. But.
Thanks. Yes, Nancy.
Chelsea Devening, Booz Allen Hamilton. How much would you say you see the opposition blocking, and this is a question regarding humanitarian aid access, how much would you say you see the opposition blocking aid to regime-controlled areas versus the regime blocking aid to opposition-controlled areas? And of those opposition groups, is it more often the more extremist Islamist groups that are hindering aid, or are we still seeing a lot of that going on the more moderate or among the more moderate groups? Thank you.
Thanks. And the third one was? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Guthrie. I'm here from the General Delegation of the PLO to the U.S. I'm here to ask actually about refugees that are going to Gaza and the West, well, not so much the West Bank, more so the Gaza territory. And, you know, Gazans are 90% refugees themselves. How are they handling the influx of Syrian Palestinian refugees who are stateless in Syria and who are especially vulnerable to the conflict as it's going on? And I also want to know what countries are being the most generous right now in terms of resettling refugees, and if resettlement is becoming an increased priority for the UNHCR and other organizations as the conflict looks to draw out into the coming years. Thank you.
Okay, why don't we start with questions about the opposition, how much they control, and why working with them?
Well, I would probably, this is a long discussion, but I would probably dispute that the opposition controls most of the population centers in Syria. If you look at the map, maybe the areas where the influential looks very impressive, but if you look at the population concentration, I believe that most is still under the control of the authorities. Now, to answer your question candidly, I think it's also because we were there in Damascus, and then we tried to grow out of Damascus, and we found out very quickly that if we would enter from Turkey, we would not be in Damascus anymore. So, as I said, it's mutually exclusive. You can't do both, and that's the problem. That's the big challenge. Those organizations that enter through Turkey illegally, according to Damascus, cannot get into those government areas, while we can imperfectly go from the regime-held areas into the opposition-held areas. And we have made the choice that we will try to push into that direction. But you have to make a decision. As I said, you can't be in both models. So it is an issue. About the opposition blocking aid, we don't see it really because, as I explained, we don't do movement from opposition-held areas into regime-held areas. What we see, however, is difficulties at checkpoints, but this is not typical to Syria. It happens in many different contexts where you have the guys in charge in this particular place. They'd like you, of course, to unload your trucks there and not to go further. It's not so much that they want to prevent you from assisting another group. They just want your stuff. So this entails also negotiations. But we can't say we have a systematic blockage by opposition for regime, because we don't travel in that direction, actually. But we do have, and that's a major challenge. I mean, it is very fragmented. We have new groups that appear on a weekly basis, new interlocutors, some of them now very radical. We have also foreigners also involved in these people who don't really know the ICRC. So it takes a lot of negotiations, as I said, both at field level and hopefully at high level. But the problem is that you can get an okay from a guy over Skype. You don't really know where the person is, and the person at the checkpoint has a very different view. So it's you should be very patient, and it makes movements very slow, unfortunately, and that can be very frustrating.
Salman, anything on the opposition or the other questions?
The only thing I would observe, first of all, even whatever area they would purport to control the opposition, as I experience, there are aircraft which can clearly tell you that you're not actually really in charge. And the aircraft, the regime's use of aircraft in this way, it's a crime against humanity. And yet this is something that they continue and persist to do. I mean, what I've noticed is just how atomized society is and how atomized the landscape is, even in the very limited experience that I've got and everything else that we hear from Syrians themselves. And, of course, that doesn't lend itself in any easy way to the kind of humanitarian support and provision that needs to be provided. Here, I would refer again to the heroic work that's being done by more local NGOs and by Syrians themselves, who are doing, I think, the overwhelming majority of that work inside those kinds of areas. The challenge here is how can international donors and actors, regional ones, the multilateral institutions, and those local actors somehow find a way of coordinating and working better together. And I have no doubt that over a period of time, this will happen. But it is happening to a certain degree. And notice, for example, Médecins Sans Frontières working with certain groups and that sort of thing. And I suspect that will continue. I would also say, in terms of just the extremist groups, time is not on our side. You are seeing, the longer this goes on, in pockets, but it's growing, a radicalization of the opposition. And that's not to say they're all extremists. They're not. But the landscape has changed and is changing. And until and when they get coordinated support and assistance and relief, as well as on the military side, we won't know the extent to which we keep guessing. I'm amused to hear the numbers that we keep hearing in the debate about who's an extremist and who's not. But let's start off by seeing how we can do the basic things that need to be done in order to protect and save and nurture human life, and then we will see. But certainly Jabhat al-Nusra didn't exist 2 years ago. ISIS didn't exist 1 year ago. I don't know what will exist in a year from now or 6 months from now, especially if we're not able to provide those basic help. Let me just say on Gaza, as somebody who used to live in Gaza at the start of the Second Intifada, and Palestinians in general, it is really quite heartbreaking to hear Palestinian refugees, the 500,000 or so inside Syria, who don't have even more difficult time to cross borders, going from place to place, searching for refuge and sustenance inside Syria. And as the report says, you know, most of these camps have now all been emptied or affected. And perhaps you would say more on that as well.
They estimate that about half of the 500,000 Syrian Palestinians have been displaced. Until recently, Lebanon was the only country that would allow Syrian Palestinians to enter. There were restrictions in the others. It's been a horrible situation. Those going inside Lebanon, I think they're about 50,000, have mostly gone to the existing Palestinian camps. In terms of resettlement, Germany has offered to take 5,000 Syrians. That resettlement is happening now out of Lebanon. Obama administration recently announced 2,000 places for Syrians. I mean, that's a drop in the bucket in terms of the need, but also just in terms of the overall U.S. resettlement program, the long, long processes of security checks and procedures mean that those procedures would need to be changed in order for significant numbers of Syrians to be able to move to relative safety. In our report, we do call for looking at a much bolder use of resettlement to demonstrate also a commitment by the international community to support those countries that are feeling the real brunt of the refugee flow. Kamal, do you want to say a word about Turkey?
Maybe just say.
Just wait for the microphone then.
I just got an email saying that this article
wrote a little bit about these issues, and Turkey has just been accepted by national interest. So you might want to. And we will also have a separate session on Turkey towards the end, early next year, more focused on. The only thing, Francois, I'd love to say about the way Turkish foreign policy has handled this is that in the case of Bosnia, Turkey was able to talk to all parties. And until about a year or two ago, Turkey was able to talk to all parties in the Middle East. This, unfortunately, is not the case. And I couldn't help, as I listened to Francois, if Turkey was still in a, or if the government was following a policy that would have allowed Turkey to speak to all the parties, maybe the Red Cross, then might have been able to operate across the line.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thanks to all of you for coming and staying until the end. I appreciate it.
Thank you.